Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. St. Louis has a wide variety of public and private buildings which reflect nicely on the city's history and heritage. There is a mix of traditional American, European, and other foreign influences side by side with a reflection of the more modern styles. And some of what has happened here has been influential as well. Most of us are familiar with how the Wainwright Building and the Eads Bridge shaped counterparts elsewhere. The Wainwright Building, for instance, will be featured in a 9-network PBS special on May 12th and 13th titled 10 Buildings That Changed America. There are many other architectural treasures here that most of us know little about. Our mission today is to highlight some of them so we can better appreciate them for what they are and for what they mean. Joining me in studio to do just that are Eric Mumford, professor at the Sam Fox School of Design and Visual Arts at Washington University. Andrew Weil is executive director of the Landmarks Association of St. Louis. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Eric, let me start with you. Can you give me kind of a thumbnail of St. Louis's importance architecturally?
Yeah. St. Louis, of course, was the fourth largest city in the country in 1900. It was enormously important in the development of the West and also in the development of American industry. And so as a result, it has a really extraordinary collection of buildings of all periods, really, going back to early French colonial structures. There's excellent things in the area. Through the 19th century, lots and lots of highly crafted buildings, many of them built by immigrants from Eastern and Southern Europe, Germans, Czechs, Italians. It is, I think, just really extraordinary just for that alone, for its 19th century and early 20th century heritage. But then layered on to that is an extraordinary flowering after World War II, which many cities didn't really see, particularly old industrial cities farther east, of remarkable modern architecture. And so St. Louis, I think, is really exceptional in that way as well. And, of course, we all know Eero Saarinen's Gateway Arch, but there are a lot of other buildings, too, that aren't nearly as well known.
It would seem to me, and Andrew, I'll put this to you, that a lot of what Eric has been talking about has been missed, eclipsed, if you will, by the Arch, which when people talk about St. Louis, that's essentially what they're going to start talking about, and not to mention Eads Bridge and the Wainwright Building.
Sure. Well, I think that people have a tendency to, if we were speaking in sort of ecological terms, they would be referred to as the charismatic megafauna, looking at the giant pandas and the elephants and everything else gets kind of pushed to the wayside. But, we have these great iconic structures and people have a tendency to focus on them, as you say. Unfortunately, I think that people have a tendency to focus on them and perhaps not get out into the neighborhoods and get out into the rest of the city and even the region as much as they should. Their gaze being too distracted and focused on these iconic buildings and not seeing the forest, only the trees.
What are we likely to find in the neighborhoods? What should we be looking for?
Well, what we should be looking for and can easily find is a great eastern city, really, and a city, if we're talking about St. Louis City, that has representations of architectural and sort of physical development that span the antebellum period all the way up through the sort of post-war, beginnings of the post-war boom. And so really St. Louis City, as you move east, in many ways is a textbook of sort of American architectural and civic development patterns, and also patterns that in some cases are fairly unique to St. Louis itself.
You can find anything you want as long as it's made out of brick.
as long as you stay east of King's Highway, yeah, that's pretty much the case.
Eric, why is that?
Well, I think a lot of it had to do with the growth of the city at an early point, and a lot of the models used were from farther east, as Andrew indicated. Philadelphia, Baltimore were cities that were of a similar pattern, and a lot of those same brick row houses and small 4 or 5-story commercial buildings were built in St. Louis as well. It was part of a national network of similar kinds of cities. What's interesting about St. Louis is a lot of those buildings here were built by immigrant artisans, and so they often acquired a kind of, in a way, more sophisticated quality than sometimes what you find, say, in Pennsylvania.
And many of the immigrants, of course, were working in the clay mines here,
exactly.
which
mm-hmm.
is the yeah. source for the brick, obviously.
Yes, that's right. The hill under it is a network of clay mines, and much of the brick and terracotta, the terracotta on the Wainwright Building, was all mined there. So it's a very interesting interplay between patterns that were, in a sense, coming from farther east, but then interpreted locally with local materials.
Oh, I thought you were going to add something there. But, let's talk about the big boys right here and get them out mm-hmm. of the way, because I think most people know about, and I've mentioned them already. Why is the Wainwright Building iconic, and what was its influence elsewhere?
Well, it's an extremely important building for a number of reasons. One is that it's a very early all-steel frame skyscraper. The Eads Bridge was one of the first long-span bridges to use a steel process called Bessemer process. It was invented in England in the 1860s, and it made steel fire-resistant. Before that, it was difficult to build in iron because it tended to buckle in a fire. So that use of high-strength steel then made possible taller buildings using steel framing. And you find that in Chicago. It's well known as a center of steel frame skyscrapers. That's where Louis Sullivan was practicing, children of Irish immigrants from Boston who made his way to Chicago. And he there became part of a circle of architects who started to innovate in high-rise design. And so the Wainwright Building, although built in St. Louis, is very much part of that pattern. It not only uses a steel frame, but it also uses a kind of external ornament that Sullivan invented based on natural patterns. And so it's important not only for its steel framing, but also for its no longer referring to the past in its architecture, that Sullivan wanted to find a kind of organic order based on nature. And that involved not only the ornament, but also the effort to express the tallness of the building, that it was unprecedentedly tall in a landscape of small brick buildings, and it towered over them. And he wanted the architecture to express that.
It's kind of laughable now to refer to it as a skyscraper, given the skyscrapers that we know exist elsewhere. Andrew, do you want to take on the Eads Bridge for a quick look?
Certainly. I mean, my expertise is not so much in the incredible significance of the engineering achievements of the Eads Bridge, although certainly I know that the spans that were used were the longest in the world at the time. And also the steel process, once again, was incredibly innovative. There's some debate as to how serious people were about doubting whether or not, because these processes and this construction method was so innovative and new, whether or not it was going to be able to support the weight of the locomotives that were to be coming across it. And so whether seriously or in jest or some mix of the two, the bridge was actually opened with a test elephant. They walked an elephant across the bridge, and many people may know that story, many others may not, in part because elephants are heavy, nothing compared to a locomotive, but also because apparently they had a reputation for not stepping onto structures that wouldn't hold them, having sort of a sense about their own weight and stability beneath them. So it's kind of an interesting story there. And the Eads Bridge as a structure, incredibly important, but as a driving force in the later development of the city, the physical development of the city, cannot be underestimated in that as soon as the Eads Bridge is created, all of a sudden we have the real impetus for the commercial district, the commercial center of downtown, moving west very, very quickly into what we consider to be downtown today and away from the original downtown commercial district that was on the riverfront.
And if I may have my dates wrong, correct me if I do, but this was just a couple of years after the Civil War that Eads Bridge went up.
1874.
Mm-hmm. 74, yeah. Okay. Yeah. What do you think is the most significant building we have in our area? And I'm kind of focusing on the city of St. Louis now because maybe that's not right to do that. But what do you think, Eric, is the most significant building we have downtown in St. Louis that nobody knows about?
That nobody knows about.
Yeah.
Probably the other Sullivan skyscraper that's a block away at Union and 7th Street. This was designed about a year after the Wainwright Building and originally called, I think, Union Trust. Andrew can probably talk more about the specifics of it. It's an interesting building that is almost unknown, and it's also by Sullivan, also very innovative in many ways in terms of its design.
It's interesting that we had a tourist in town the other day. Frequently we have people come through our door looking for various buildings, we got a call from the convention center saying, we've got someone here who's looking for Louis Sullivan's other building, and he's been wandering around the Wainwright Building, and I got on the phone and said, it's 705, it's the Union Trust Building, and he said, aha, and ran out the door. So there are definitely people who know about that building and appreciate that building and coming in from out of town to see that building.
What's the most frequent request that you get?
Well, it just depends on who's coming in. A lot of it has to do with the conventions. Depending on who's in town, people want to see different things. Recently, we've had a lot of miners in town, and so we've had a lot of people coming through the door and looking at our Lucas Place exhibit that's up right now that we did in conjunction with the Campbell House. And these are people from the Southeast in many cases, and they're looking at the names of the people who owned the homes in Lucas Place and recognizing the names of Civil War generals on both sides who are living next door to each other, essentially.
Yeah.
We also would have had several researchers come in town from Japan, interestingly enough, who are doing research on William Itner, another very prominent St. Louis architect.
I have his name on my list. He's the guy that designed all the schools, right?
Right, that's right. Most of the schools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about churches? We haven't mentioned them. And, of course, we've got the old cathedral, the new cathedral. Mm-hmm. How do they stack up in the scheme of things, Eric?
Well, again, St. Louis is amazing as a sort of layered architectural history where from the early 19th century forward, you have all different kinds of church types, a lot of Gothic churches, many of them built by German congregations after the Civil War, but all kinds of other churches as well. What I've found particularly interesting here are the modern churches. What was considered the first modern building in St. Louis was St. Mark's Episcopal in South St. Louis Hills from the late 1930s, designed by Dunn and Nagel. And today it looks relatively classical, but was considered quite radically modern at the time. And then after World War II, quite a number of modernist churches and synagogues were built, many of them in St. Louis County, that were quite innovative. Eric Mendelssohn's, originally a synagogue in University City, which is now called COCA, it's been preserved as an art center. That's an amazing, innovative structure by an architect who was one of the leading modernists in Germany in the 1920s, who then came to the United States. And that inspired a whole lot of other, many Catholic churches by the firm of Murphy and Mackey, the Resurrection Church in Dutchtown in South St. Louis, lots of others throughout the area. So for me, that's a particularly interesting aspect of St. Louis churches.
And Andrew, given your interest in neighborhoods, the churches certainly are a huge part of all of our neighborhoods.
Absolutely, and especially when you get into the older neighborhoods where you had live, work, play, pray spaces all kind of in sort of cellular units almost. You have the churches. St. Louis really is a city of steeples, and each one of those served individual communities. And on the opposite end of the spectrum from what Eric was just mentioning, the modern churches, we also have extant churches going back to the 1830s in St. Louis, beginning with the old cathedral. We also have St. Mary of Victories and St. Vincent de Paul down on the near south side, which both date to the 1840s, the latter being designed, I believe, by an architect named Meriwether Lewis Clark, who was the son of William Clark. Unfortunately, it's a sad state of affairs in many areas of the city with these absolutely immense cathedrals that today lack congregations or lack congregations of the size that are capable of supporting them. And, of course, buildings of this size require an immense amount of money and upkeep.
Sure.
And
sure. Maintenance,
We definitely have a problem with that, as do many cities.
Well, I have to take a break now. It's a fascinating discussion. I think and hope that people are beginning to get the idea that there's much to look for and much to learn about what's all around us. Perhaps we've passed by these buildings and never given them a second thought. Perhaps now folks will. My guests in studio are Eric Mumford, professor of the Sam Fox School of Design and Visual Arts at Washington University. Also with me is Andrew Weil, executive director of the Landmarks Association here in St. Louis. We want to get our audience into the listening audience into the conversation. You can do so at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK to help you remember that number. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air. You can also reach us through Facebook. Back to continue this conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation about the architecture of St. Louis. And while we're focusing on the city of St. Louis, I know I'm going to be criticized for kind of putting the county aside, but let me try to eliminate some of that. Can you, either of you gentlemen, tell me what significance we have out there in St. Louis County that folks should know about?
Sure. Well, I think the airport is one building that people tend to take for granted, the main terminal at Lambert, designed by Minoru Yamasaki in 1950, and a very innovative use of thin-shell concrete vaulting. It was one of the first big passenger airports after World War II that was designed to accommodate the new emerging industry, which TWA was a prime example at the time, designed by a firm called Helmuth, Yamasaki, and Lineweber, who also designed the rather infamous Pruitt-Igoe housing project at the same time, since demolished. But that firm then kind of gave rise to HOK, the big St. Louis firm. Gio Obata was Minoru Yamasaki's assistant on the airport, and then he went on with George Helmuth to found HOK a year later, 1956. So it's significant both for the history of St. Louis, for the history of post-war corporate architecture. HOK went on to be at one point the largest firm in the world, and very important for its technology, for the use of thin-shell concrete. So I would say that's a major St. Louis County building. I believe it's actually run by the city, but
yes,
yes. But it is certainly in the county. Another good example of that same technology is Gio Obata's Priory Chapel at the St. Louis Priory School out in West County. That was an early and influential use of thin shell concrete vaulting. Very, very interesting building, well worth a visit if people get a chance to. There's also a Frank Lloyd Wright House in Kirkwood, which is now known as the Frank Lloyd Wright House in Ebsworth Park. That's open for tours, and people can arrange to visit it. It's a post-war Frank Lloyd Wright House, part of the houses that he designed in the 50s called Usonian houses that were meant to be very affordable for ordinary people, and brilliantly sited, incredibly detailed, really well worth seeing. There are also some other Frank Lloyd Wright houses that are not open to the public in the county. So those are probably the main things, I would say.
Yeah, I probably should have kept my mouth shut when I said let's just focus on the city, because obviously there's much in the county that could be discussed.
Well, and there is, and I think one of the primary issues and why it's easier to speak about the city is that the city is older and it's had more time for the scholarship to recognize the importance of the architectural patterns and the building patterns, the development patterns. We just frankly know more about it because we've had more time to think about it. And the county being so much newer, these are areas where scholarship is really just beginning to really kind of tackle the investigations into the significance of the patterns and building types that we find.
That's kind of where I was heading in all of this, and it's so much more concentrated too, so it's mm-hmm. it's easier to kind of visualize. While we're on the subject of the county, one of the places that always comes to my mind is the City Hall in University City, mm-hmm. which is an unusual building.
Yep.
How does that stack up and rate with other structures?
Well, it's quite interesting because it's a high-rise city hall, which is unusual.
Yeah.
And it also is part of a kind of city beautiful composition of monumental buildings originally developed by Edgar G. Lewis, who was a kind of entrepreneur and magazine publisher who founded University City. It's named actually not after Washington University, as people often think, but off of Lewis's People's University, that it was a mail-order university he founded there. He eventually had to leave the state state for, I guess, tax evasion or something. And the buildings then were taken over by University City. Not only is there the City Hall there, but then various other buildings used for different purposes, some churches, various other structures that create a very interesting monumental composition, very characteristic of the era of the St. Louis World's Fair. It was built right around that same time, and there was this whole effort to create monumental civic centers in American cities.
And I would say that University City as well is typical of a pattern that of development that dominated St. Louis County in the late 19th and early 20th century, and that was with the rail or streetcar suburb nuclei springing up. And these are the towns, the various towns that give names to the various municipalities that we have in St. Louis County, even though they've ceased to become discrete units and the neighborhoods have sort of, you know, for lack of a better term, spread or sprawled between them and connected them all into a vast area that's collectively known as St. Louis County but was once, you know, dotted with these individual towns, mm-hmm. discrete towns.
You know, with the mentioning City Hall, I wanted to get to downtown St. Louis once again, and Ed will bring us there. He's on the phone. Ed, go ahead with your question or comment, please.
Yeah, I'd just like to comment. I live in St. Louis Hills, and I can see from my front porch St. Mark's Church, which was mentioned in there, and it is a nice church. But when I was a kid in high school, there was a picture of St. Louis City Hall in my history book, and it said it was based on the French City Hall. I can remember that. And for 16 years, I worked in the Missouri Pacific Railroad building. Really, and I could see it, and I could see City Hall from my office sometimes. And I would just like to say, just finally, I'd like to say, because I've been in that building, the railroad building, just recently.
Railroad Exchange?
No.
Oh, the Missouri Pacific.
Camel X is going to have their, you know, offices there, really. This is a 22-story building, and you can right across there. But I've also been in City Hall recently, and I'll say if they would maintain the interior of City Hall like the railroad maintained that building, but I guess the mayor doesn't walk through City Hall very often.
Thanks for the call.
I would say that it may be a little bit unfair considering that the Missouri Pacific building just underwent an absolutely enormous rehab by the Lawrence Group and received one of our Landmarks Association's most enhanced buildings awards for excellence in rehabilitation in 2012. City Hall has not undergone an extensive interior renovation or rehabilitation recently. Personally, I think that the interior of City Hall is in pretty good shape, and it's also quite stunning, and it would be worth a field trip for anyone who's coming into the city, because it certainly is an iconic building, and really the exterior and the interior are both outstanding.
It looks very French to me, yes. Eric Mumford.
Yes, it's based on the Hotel de Ville in Paris, the City Hall of Paris, yeah.
Well, anything more we can say about that? I mean, it's very ornate. It is very striking. It could use a sandblasting or something to pretty it up.
Yeah, that's a perennial question. And, you know, the answer is somewhere, why does it have that appearance? And it has to do with a mistaken cleaning job years ago, is my understanding. Mm. But, you know, it could look sparkling and new, or it could look weathered and interesting the way it does now. But I don't think that really that effect really detracts terribly from the architectural impression.
No, but the downtown library, for instance, and the work that's just been done there really illustrates what can be done and bring something back to life. What a great job that is.
Absolutely. Like. I mean, that's canon design, and I think it's just extraordinary job that they did on that.
Go ahead, Andrew.
Well, just that building is winning a Most Enhanced Award this year. And, in fact, we're having our award ceremony there for excellence in historic restoration and preservation on May 15th in the evening. And that's an event that's open to the public. So if people are interested in purchasing tickets to that and coming and celebrating what's right with the region in terms of rehabilitation, and you can look up our website, landmarks-stl.org, and call our office and come see what's been accomplished in the last year.
We'll put a link to that website on ours at stlpublicradio.org so folks can get to that more easily. That's the 15th, you say?
That's right, May.
What about preservation efforts, Eric, in the city? How do we do? I mean, we're reading in the paper about Couples Warehouse 7. Yeah. Looks like it's as good as gone, at least at this moment.
Yeah, well, St. Louis, you know, when I've been here about 19 years, and when I got here, it was you know, basically seemed like it was on its way to abandonment. And I'm amazed, really, at how much has been accomplished in that time in terms of preserving a lot of really important buildings in St. Louis and enhancing them. The whole culture here has changed tremendously around preservation. I mean, you know, I would hear people argue that old buildings couldn't be saved because they couldn't accommodate large ducks, and, you know, really kind of crazy arguments about
that's
why.
That's D-U-C-T-S.
Yes,
right,
ducks, right. That's right. And that's all just, you know, changed completely, which I think is great. There is the problem that St. Louis was a much larger and actually a major industrial city, which it no longer is, that we don't have, you know, many, many immigrants moving in every year to work in factories. And so that does mean there's a lot of buildings that are underutilized. But I think now that's starting to be recognized as kind of a source of strength, that there's a lot of opportunities here for people to move in, to live inexpensively in really amazing spaces, houses, all kinds of things. So I think in the end, it may really turn around. I think there probably will inevitably be more losses. I mean, there's just, in a way, more buildings than can be easily reused. But nonetheless, I think there's a lot that's been saved.
And then there's a problem, Andrew, with historic preservation tax credits and things that are much talked about.
Certainly. One of the probably the most important factor in retaining and revitalizing huge areas of St. Louis and really setting them on a path to a much brighter future than what was envisioned just a few decades ago has been the importance of the Missouri State Historic Rehabilitation Tax Credit. And I know that that's not intended to be the focus of today's discussion,
sure,
but it is truly the most important preservation issue, large picture preservation issue going on right now. And it is currently being debated between the state House and Senate, and could very well be slashed to a level where it ceases to function. And that would really be a disaster for St. Louis City and also for many, many other sort of core, older core communities all across the state.
Subject in and of itself for another time. Let's go back to the phones and bring in Rich calling from the Bevo neighborhood. Go ahead, Rich.
Morning, Don.
Hi.
A couple things I'd like to bring up. The restaurant that Anheuser-Busch built, the Bevo Mill, Al Smith's Feasting Fox, and the Stork Inn, which I don't believe is open right now, those were special buildings built as hospitality places by the brewery. And I also glad that St. Vincent de Paul Church was brought up, because I recall reading in Life on the Mississippi, Mark Twain described the steeple as looking like it was designed as a bedpost. And when I read that, I knew exactly what he was talking about. And that's what I have to say today.
All right. Thanks very much. Who wants to respond? Go ahead, Andrew.
It's actually interesting that you mention it. It's almost like you're a plant. Our last newsletter that came out this spring, I have a large article entitled "The St. Louis Tavern Buildings of Anheuser-Busch: A Constructed Message." And we recently nominated the Bevo Mill building itself and the surrounding commercial district as a small National Register district down there at the behest of the alderwoman. And in the process of doing that research, I mean, everyone knows that those sort of the Stork Inn, which actually is an architectural firm's office today, it's not a tavern, but it has been rehabilitated and is occupied. But the big ones, the Bevo Mill, the Stork Inn, and what was originally Bush's Inn or the Gretchen Inn, now known as the Feasting Fox, there are a number of other taverns, and we're learning about more of them every day, that the not only Anheuser-Busch but the other big brewers built across St. Louis in the really the run-up to Prohibition, as they really came to dominate the tavern trade. And these buildings in particular are really iconic and landmark buildings in various neighborhoods and for their surrounding neighborhoods, and they were designed to be exactly that. It's a long story, but our the newsletter article is up on our website once again, and I think it's a pretty good summary of the reasons that those buildings came to be.
Eric, who had a greater influence on our architecture, would you say, the Germans or the French?
I think in the end the Germans. Although St. Louis was founded by the French, in the end it became a heavily Germanic city culturally, a very international city at the same time. But I think, the city has and its arts generally have a strong Germanic influence.
Someone told me once that the tenement, which we're so familiar with in terms of New York City and the immigrants that lived in tenement houses at the turn of the 20th century, that the tenement actually started here and that some of them still exist on the near north side. Now, that could be false information, doesn't it?
I think so. Yeah. There certainly is a lot of overlap between different cities, that parallels can be drawn between New York and European cities and perhaps here. But the Lower East Side tenement of New York is really not a St. Louis building type.
Although there were more immigrants in St. Louis in the mid-1800s than there were in New York City at that time.
That's true.
Yeah. I think the tenement's more useful to consider the tenement as a category of building that has many, many iterations all across the country, anywhere where you had a need for density.
Mm-hmm. Have to take another break. Let's do that now. Come back. We have a lot of phone calls. I promise I'll spend more time on the phones than talking myself when we come back. My guests in studio, Eric Mumford, professor at the Sam Fox School of Design and Visual Arts at Washington University. He's with me in studio, as is Andrew Weil, executive director of the Landmarks Association of St. Louis. Back to continue our conversation on St. Louis architecture in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our discussion on St. Louis architecture and some of the treasures we have that most of us know very little about. We're trying to fix that today, at least get people interested in starting to learn more. Very quickly, before I go to the phones, and Andrew, I'll turn this to you. If people have become inspired by listening to this to learn more, how can they do that? Is there some place to go, your place, for instance, to learn more?
Certainly. Our library and our organization is really dedicated to helping people to come to understand and appreciate the architecture of St. Louis. It's our primary focus. And as an organization, we focus a lot of efforts on education and also on promotion, in addition to our advocacy and sort of policy work. But we try to provide many, many opportunities for people to get out and explore areas that they may not be familiar with and they may have misconceptions about, and many opportunities for guest speakers to come and visit your organization and to talk about a wide variety of topics. And we'd be happy to work with people to create programming that works for them.
I'm going to the phones now, but I have a list of things I wanted to know more about. There's no way we'll have time to do this. When I think of the old Kiel Opera House, Peabody now, I think of the Fox Theater, Pruitt-Igoe, which was mentioned, the Downtown Library, the Art Museum, Powell Hall, Sheldon, Union Station, the old courthouse. Maybe we can get to talk about some of these things, but I think now we have to go to the phones and let the listeners dictate the conversation. George and Arnold, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Thank you for your letting me on your line, guys. You have a very interesting conversation. I would like to throw into the hat St. Cedar and Paul Soulard. The whole outside has been renovated. We've went through all our lead glass windows and redid them. We have windows from Germany. We have stations that are across from Germany. But the crown jewel is the interior seating has been completely renovated into the circular format with everybody can see everybody and have a really good liturgy. Thank you for letting me make my piece.
Thanks for calling.
I would really agree with that. I come in every morning from South City to work downtown, and I pass over near Lafayette Square, and I look east with the sun kind of rising through the steeples of Soulard, and the, of course, St. Peter and Paul is very prominent on that horizon there, and it's absolutely beautiful. And it's a beautiful church, and they're to be commended on the work that they've done.
Let's bring in Mike calling from University City. I know he has a question that a lot of people might have. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi, Don. Yeah, I haven't heard any mention about our famous water towers. And incidentally, they open once a month through the summer season, and they're going to be open this Saturday from, like, I think from noon to 4. And it's one of the most spectacular viewing platforms of the city, and I recommend it. And I would like to hear if you know more about these water towers that we have here. We've got two up north, too.
Mike, do you have any expertise in this area? Eric, I'm sorry.
Well, not a huge amount. I do know that they were built to keep pressure in the system, that the water supply system was mostly built in the 1870s and was quite advanced for its time, and that those towers were necessary in the beginning to keep pressure so when you opened a tap, the water would actually flow out. They're quite important architecturally for the city also, and I think the one on North Grand is supposed to be the largest
freestanding
Corinthian column in the world. Right. That's right.
Yeah. And there's also, of course, the red water tower up there. There's the only one that's actually open, to my knowledge, is the Compton Hill Water Tower. And that is open during the summer and on during the day, on the weekends, and for the full moons. And that's really an incredible experience. That's certainly an iconic building, definitely in the best shape of all three. The two north side ones are unfortunately in pretty rough shape and deteriorating. And there really are very, very few of these standpipe water towers from the Victorian era still in the United States. And I believe St. Louis has the largest collection at three. But the Compton Hill Water Tower that you mentioned being opened is designed by an architect named Harvey Ellis, 1896, I believe.
Yeah. That always reminds me of the space shuttle getting ready to take off. Somehow. Maybe NASA used that as its model. Who knows?
Who knows, right?
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones. And Tom calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Tom.
Hello. Hey, guys. Great show. I just wanted to add two items, one a building and the other a complex. The building is the old post office on Olive, which there was a struggle to preserve it 40, 50 years ago, and it was successful, and it's an outstanding building, very little discussed, and I hope it lasts forever and hope it gets a repurpose that will enable it to be there forever. The complex is the Lemp Brewery complex that is a walled brewery that reminds me a little bit of Ghirardelli Square in San Francisco. And when Gaslight Square was dying, I was suggesting that they make that into the entertainment complex because it's very easy to control people coming in and out because of the wall around it. And at that time, I worked for International Shoe, which owned that complex. So anyway, two items to talk about or go look at, which are very interesting.
I completely agree with you on both points. The old post office, designed by Alfred Bolt Mullett, completed in 1884, I believe. He was an architect commissioned by the federal government to create post office and customs houses in important cities, and completely constructed of granite, thoroughly rehabbed and repurposed several years ago. It's fully leased with court functions. I believe Webster University has a component down there. St. Louis Public Library has a branch, and also Local Harvest Cafe and Grocery is down there as well. So that building is really thriving, and you're right, it was on the verge of being torn down, and that really vitriolic statements about what a hulk and heap it was, and what a piece of junk cluttering up downtown from the late 50s and early 60s, and it's really goes to show how far opinions of architecture can swing in one direction or another. And of course, the Lemp Brewery being the largest intact, really pre-prohibition brewery in the country, and is owned by a couple of guys who really, really love the place and have done a heck of a lot of work to keep it up and have very big plans for a bright future for that building. So rest assured, it's definitely in loving hands and should have a very bright future as well.
I've got a couple of emails and tweets I'd like to get very quick answers to. One from Tom: do we have any other Saarinen buildings in the St. Louis area? Eric, do you know?
Not actually in the St. Louis area, but there is a chapel by Eero Saarinen out at in Columbia, Missouri, for a women's college out there.
Tweet here. Jefferson Barracks, historic site in St. Louis County, has some great old buildings. What sort of attention should we pay to that, Andrew?
Well, I think that they're doing a lot more down there. They've created the new Missouri Civil War History Museum. I have not been – I'm not, you know, really up to date on what's going on down there. But certainly that was an incredibly important federal military installation west of the Mississippi. Has an enormous Civil War history. The U.S. Cavalry School was there, and there's definitely some fantastic buildings associated with its 19th century history.
Email from Samantha. Could you talk about the design of the Fox Theater? Is there a reason for this Thai Buddhist-looking theme? That's not something that I've necessarily noticed. That strike a responsive chord in either of you guys.
I wouldn't call it a Thai Buddhist.
I would think
sort of Moorish revival.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was a popular idiom in the Gilded Age. It was a way of really going over the top with ornament. And it was just the design scheme that was chosen for that theater, which really was over the top in its scale and size, and was designed to really knock your socks off, and it continues to do that today.
Yeah, it has a kind of twin in Detroit where there's also a Fox Theater by the same architect.
Well, a lot of them were constructed about the same
That's
time,
right.
as I recall.
Right.
Yeah, the heyday, I guess, of the early movie industry. Let's take another call. Olga from Florissant will join us. Olga, thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Yes. My dad, Croatian immigrant and a master stonemason, and many St. Louis is gifted with all this beautiful stonework. Many of the Rosetta windows in the city are the kind of work my dad did. And the beautiful granite masonry at Washington U, which, bless them, they've continued to carry out that theme with each of their additions. That serpentine brick wall around the zoo. You can go to the poorest neighborhood in the city and see some of the most beautiful lintels above windows and eaves.
It's true.
In brick design. And the red brick of St. Louis is much more beautiful than the yellow brick of Chicago. But the signature of the masons and the bricklayers here is just phenomenal.
Olga, thanks for the call. We've alluded to this before, but the fact that we had such an influx of immigrants and artisans really increased what we have, I don't know how many fold, but certainly played an important role.
Yeah, certainly so. And we were graced and blessed with absolutely immense clay product industry here. From the end of the Civil War through the early 20th century. You know, by the turn of the century, St. Louis was the largest brick-producing city in the entire world. Mm. And Hydraulic Press Brick Company, the largest brick producer, was based here. And because of our incredible clay resources, we had really, really cheap brick. And that means everybody built out of it, and that means there was a huge market for masons. So the level of skill of masonry that we see in common St. Louis homes, I know that's been discussed before on this very program, is truly outstanding and really an asset.
And Eric, that brick now is being shipped out of St. Louis.
Houses are
destroyed, and it's very valuable elsewhere.
Yeah, that's right. It's famously patios in Texas made of North St. Louis brick. Yeah.
All right, back to the phones. Dan in South City, or South County, I believe it is. Go ahead, Dan. You're on the air.
Sure. Yeah, thanks for having me on. I had a question. I think, you know, if you look at St. Louis City in general, and I used to be a city resident, you know, a lot of this could be helped by just a larger population, particularly younger people and families. And this has to do with architecture also. I was wondering if there were any programs out there to preserve residential architecture, which could go a couple different ways. One could be money to help convert four-family flats to, you know, to two units or to a single-family unit. Or perhaps to go the other way, you know, for really large, you know, single-family homes that could be tastefully converted into, you know, a multifamily use.
Certainly so, and that's really what we're seeing happen a lot, an immense amount. And A lot of that is supported by National Register of Historic Districts, which facilitate both state and federal rehabilitation tax credits. So there's an incentive there. Other than that, there really are not financial incentives in place, although I'm hopeful that there may be an opportunity with the mayor's new sustainability plan and new focus on sustainability. Of course, rehabilitating and reoccupying these buildings is an incredibly sustainable thing to do, and there may be some opportunity for the city to create some kind of incentives for repair or rehabilitation in order to keep hanging on to and bringing the incredible amounts of beautiful housing stock that we still have back.
Let's take a call from Tom in Afton. Go ahead.
Thank you, Don. A quick comment and a question. The arch, I know you wanted to get away from the megafauna, but I had some opportunity to see some other Saarinen designs in New Haven, the old international terminal at JFK in New York City, some buildings in Chicago and Minnesota. And when you come back to St. Louis and look at the arch in the context of his career and the other architecture of the time, I think it's just brilliant. I mean, I had to leave St. Louis and come back to really appreciate, the thing that I had grown up with. And my question is, I used to really love the way the top of the old Busch Stadium mirrored or reflected, with the little arches along the top. And I wonder if your guests think the new stadium is successful in kind of reiterating the themes of downtown architecture and relating to the arch.
Well, Eric, you look like you want to turn away from this one, but give it a try.
Well, I like the Cardinals, certainly, yeah. And I understand the importance of that for St. Louis. So I think the new stadium works well. Personally, I like the Edward Durrell Stone, that aspect of it. And it was an uncomfortable stadium in a lot of ways, but it was certainly a beautiful work of architecture.
Yeah. I think the new stadium functions very well as well, and I will reiterate the Go Redbirds sentiment. I do find it somewhat ironic that the stadium was constructed out of brick that was brought in from out of town. We have so much brick here, and also that the architecture of the stadium was specifically designed to reference the couples complex adjacent to it, and currently we're in a position, unfortunately, where it looks like we're going to be tearing down the last standing important component of that complex. We have the brand new stadium talking to the complex, and yet we're continuing to hollow out that complex piece by piece.
It's going to be a one-sided conversation before too long, apparently. Time's getting away. We have an email from Andy. I'll synopsize. It's a long piece, but he talks about the caves, of which there are so many under St. Louis, and he wonders if you gentlemen can tie together on the relationship between buildings and caves in St. Louis. Do you see any dots to be connected here, either of you?
Oh, absolutely. If you were to map all of the breweries in St. Louis, you would effectively have drawn yourself a map of all of the caves in St. Louis. The caves were extensively used for cold storage prior to the invention of refrigeration. Especially the pattern is particularly evident in the Soulard area, where at one time in sort of South St. Louis, there an incredibly large cave system and incredible concentration of brewing buildings there, the surviving ones, big ones being Lemp and Anheuser-Busch, both of which are situated over cave complexes.
Time is getting away. I just want to mention a couple of the things that we haven't talked about. We haven't talked about the brewery, the old courthouse, Union Station, even the Taco Bell building, which has been so much of the news this year. That didn't get into the conversation. Again, you can contact the Landmarks Association for more information. Eric Mumford of Washington U, is there a final thought? What would you want the takeaway to be from for people who are listening to this?
Well, I think that St. Louis, because it has this amazing architecture, really should be more aware of that, and that should be more generally known. I think that it's a real asset to the city, and it's part of its very complex and complex international past, and I think that that should become more broadly known generally. And I think that, you know, Landmarks does a lot to make that happen, and I think there are other ways that can happen also.
I meant Del Taco, of course, not Taco Bell. It's my last day of the week, folks. Give me a break. Final thought in 15 seconds, Andrew?
Pretty much that if you're not familiar with St. Louis, if you've grown up in the region and you haven't spent much time in the city is open for business, and it's got incredible wealth of residential architecture in particular that is looking for loving families to move into it and bring it back and come help the rest of us that are actively working on that and have been for quite a while.
Well, I hope this program today will help inspire people to do that. Eric Mumford of Washington University and Sam Fox School of Design, thank you for being with us today. And
thank you.
And Andrew Weil, thank you so much from the Landmarks
You're
Association.
Welcome.
We mentioned early on 10 buildings that changed America, that it was featuring the Wainwright Building, will air on the Nine Network Sunday and Monday, May 12th and 13th at 9 p.m., 10 Buildings That Changed America. Again, gentlemen, thank you so much for being here. Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape, and he'll talk with soprano Christine Brewer about her recent world travels and her performances this weekend with the St. Louis Symphony, with Broadway star Norbert Leo Butz about his appearance to benefit the Angel Band Project, and with fashion designer Michael Drummond about his involvement in an exhibition at the Regional Arts Commission. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with West County native and former NBC anchor Stone Phillips about his PBS documentary about caring for aging parents. Then we'll check in with the Beacon's Rob Koenig about the latest activities of regional interest in our nation's capital. He'll be with us in studio on Monday. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Aaron Dorr, Spencer Reed, and Drew Becker. Executive producers Robert Peterson. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.